Welcome to the Totem Figures Podcast. I'm TJ Duh. Rodney DeCru is a Vancouver-based singer-songwriter, poet, and blogger. He's released 6 albums and a book of poetry, with another book on the way. He concluded his most recent Canadian tour, his most successful yet, by firing his band and withdrawing from his record label, and he'll get to that in the interview. His totems are Bob Dylan, poet Philip Levine, and Mark Twain, specifically the novel Huckleberry Finn. We started out talking about Bob Dylan. But first, here's one of Rodney's own songs, Sheltering Sky, from his live album, War Torn Man. As that sidewalk fades to black, you remember when I found you standing down there by them railroad tracks? Remember how you took my arm? I said it was a lack.
I really heard about Dylan was when I was in Christian school.
Part of my family are Southern Baptists, and it's very strict stuff. We had a choir teacher, a music teacher at the school, who was a Christian.
And this was in the States?
In the States, in Western Pennsylvania, okay. Just outside of Pittsburgh. The music teacher, obviously, she was one of these freaky Christians, very much had been a hippie and part of the counterculture movement of the 60s and 70s, but then she went on to find Jesus. But she still loved Bob Dylan. But she couldn't reconcile herself to liking Dylan because he was now, his older stuff was basically the enemy.
Because it was secular?
A, simply because it was secular. I mean, we weren't allowed to listen to secular music. B, because he also represented that 60s counterculture, which was represented humanism, which was bad stuff as far as the Southern Baptists are concerned.
Why?
Because they're fundamentalists. Humanism is placing your belief and trust in something that's flawed. You know, it's placing human beings at the center of the universe and not God. God's at the center of the universe, and he has a very clear set of fucking rules, and they're in the Bible, and you follow them. And that, you know, there's no room for homosexuality, there's no room for feminism. You respected the state, you respected authority, because those were God intended for them. This stuff is never really explained how they arrive at this. It's somehow in the Bible. And you fucking do it, or you're damned.
And where do you see the secular humanism showing up in Bob Dylan's work?
Well, he told stories, right, about people struggling. His characters are wrestling with life on life's terms, not through the filter of the dogmatism of theology. I mean, even something like Tangled Up in Blue, I mean, just the narrative of that song. I mean,
early one morning, the sun was shining, he was lying in bed, wondering if she changed it all of her hair was still red. Her folks, they said her life's together, sure was gonna be rough. They never did like mama's homemade dress, papa's bank book wasn't big enough. And he was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on his shoes, heading out for the old East Coast, Lord knows he's paid some dues, getting through.
Yeah, I mean, really, I also think, too, Dylan, and for a lot of them, like people like this teacher of mine, she had loved him when she was younger and continued to love him but couldn't justify it because it ran afoul of her current beliefs. A lot of it is simple, it's just association. He was associated with the 60s. He was associated with drug use. He was associated with the civil rights movement. I mean, all kinds of things. I mean, you know, there was an association between him and Ginsberg, and Ginsberg is Buddhist, so that's evil, right? I mean...
So how did this teacher...
Oh, anyhow, she was
excited about his album Save, because then he became a Christian and we were able to listen to that at school.
In the time of my confession, in the hour of my deepest need, when the pool of tears beneath my feet flood every newborn seed, there's a dying voice within me reaching out somewhere, toiling in the danger and in the morrows of despair. Don't have the inclination to look back on any mistake. Like Cain, I now behold this chain of events that I must break.
In the future, I remember being surprised by it because it wasn't the same old, tired, religious sort of hymnal cliches. But Dylan was actually, he was the right wing. I mean, he became a fundamentalist Christian for a while. You know, he even gave sermons at his concerts, but he was still being creative even within that. And that amazed me.
And the weeds of yesteryear, like criminals, they have choked the breath of conscience in good cheer.
And did you know of him otherwise when you first...
No, I mean, I hadn't heard of him, but I mean, I was a little cold. I grew up in a steel and coal town in western Pennsylvania. Bob Dylan wasn't a big cultural icon. You know, there was, you know, obviously the country music thing. There was the blues rock, you know, so, and then artists like Bob Seger, you know, that kind of stuff was what you heard. You know. Anyhow, that was the first time I heard him, and I was kind of in, thought, oh... But I pushed it away. And then in my mid-20s, I was working at a little cafe in Gastown called Soda's. But they were playing Dylan over the radio. And it's one of those intangible things, because it wasn't anything he was saying. It was just the sound of the songs, the voice, the feeling that was coming through what he was saying, and the way he was singing it, and the songs. I can't explain it.
Do you have any recollection of what period of his career that was?
It was early, early, early Dylan.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like the early protest.
Yeah, all that stuff. But there was just a quality to it that was riveting.
Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe. But I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain.
All through my sort of late 20s, I got into listening to all the eras of Dylan. I mean, I think Time Out of Mind and is right up there with stuff he did in the 60s and some of the high points in the 70s. I think all along the way, he's had these moments where he's put out great records.
Do you think the albums from his Christian period stand up at all?
Yeah. Every Grain of Sand, Joker Man, that's a great record. Those are great songs. They're right up there if anything else he's written, in my opinion.
Distant ships sailing into the mist. You were born with a snake in both your fists while a hurricane was blowing.
That's one of the things I find interesting about Dylan is that also is that he's always done his own thing. He's also been a huge cultural icon, so people associate various things with Dylan, but I mean, he's always kind of done his own deal, and I really like that.
Yeah, he's always slipped past people's expectations.
Yeah, and I think some of that has been willful, mm-hmm. right? Because it's been a survival mechanism as an artist and as a human being, right? I think. I mean, I don't know the man. But I've always admired that, you know, he's seen
I know this sounds hokey, but when I made the decision to like let go of the band and to leave the label, because I felt like this, being on the road, I felt like this is weird. We're getting bigger turnouts than we've ever had, and in my stomach, I was feeling this feeling like this is done. I'm like, no, it can't be done. We're just starting to see some good rewards here. I'm like, yeah, it's over. It's over. And then I remember thinking, I'm going to have to let it go. And then I thought, well, what would Dylan do if he felt that way? And I thought, Dylan would let go. He'd let it go.
He needs to reinvent himself.
Yeah. So.
And keep pursuing something that inspires.
Yeah, and I think that's important.
You'll start fishing chips well there. Set the sail, your messenger, he found me. Told me this tale, he said you die so rattling like teeth in your head. And you've been singing songs about dying in your bed. But that long-legged man with that knowing smile, he's been walking right beside you for many a mile. But you know I heard that rumor that you're gonna break that chain.
Philip Levine.
Well, you know, I came from, you know, Pittsburgh, just outside of Pittsburgh. When I say Pittsburgh, we lived about half an hour from downtown Pittsburgh. But Pittsburgh is kind of this weird thing, like it's the city proper, and then there's all the towns around it, because they all feed the mills, right? I grew up in a very working class, blue collar, you know, people either worked in the mills, steel mills, or they worked in coal mines. Or they worked on the railroads transporting stuff. It was a world rife with alcoholism. People lived hard lives and they had to shut themselves down in order to survive, if that makes any sense. So there wasn't a lot of interest in things like poetry, music outside of a narrow kind of musical experience. People dulled their sensitivity. It was a very physical place. A lot of fighting, like I grew up. I learned having to fight all my childhood. It was a pretty, in many ways, a brutal place. And then we lived in sort of a more run-down part because my mom was on welfare and she had three boys, and we lived above a tire shop, a tire garage, and it was a tough world that we were a part of. But I was kind of like this weird kid in that I could play sports, I could fight, I could survive that world, and yet I didn't want to be there. And I had all these feelings that I couldn't understand, and a sensitivity that was a weakness in that world. When I found Levine, he's from Detroit. He's from working class Detroit. And he grew up in a Jewish American family. Their history as a family was, there was a lot of struggle. You know, they wrestled with a lot of things that my family wrestled with. Poverty, jobs that were grueling and grinding and took everything from you and gave very little back. And he wrote about those things.
How did you discover his writing?
I discovered his writing through a friend, Chris Hutchison, because I discovered poetry in my 20s. And then I was very deeply, poetry just spoke to that side of me that never had a place before, that had to be medicated, because there was no place for it in the world I was a part of. And so, you know, I was never really fully a guy who could, like, I come from, like, real working class, lower working class roots, right? And yet I was never fully at ease with that community because a lot of those guys, I had very little in common with them except that I was from there. And I could relate to the things they felt, but I couldn't bring my interest in poetry to that. I couldn't bring my interest in the lyrics of Bob Dylan to that world. They'd be like, you know, are you a fag? And yet I was still a guy who was, you know, who had a lifetime of fistfights in it. Behind him, who had been in jail, who has been in psych wards, who is edgy, who's got fucking PTSD, is not a nice, polished, middle-class kid. So a lot of the artists who are from the, you know, are middle-class folk, feel uncomfortable around me because I was volatile, I was unpredictable, I said things that made them uncomfortable. My response to the situation was, well, you know, was a
poor working class, oh, poor kids' response from Pittsburgh. Fuck you, buddy. Right? They didn't say fuck you, buddy, to each other. They pretended like nothing happened. Like, it didn't fit in anywhere. And, like, Levine was, he kind of had a lot of those elements, too, I felt. And there's an anger to Levine.
So what are frequent subjects in his poetry?
The struggle of people coming to terms with sort of the spiritual poverty of working class America.
What lasting impact on your work would you say he's had?
Just to follow my own voice and to value my own experiences and not to tailor them to meet anyone else's agenda or expectations. I mean, when I say that he writes about working class people and people who have struck, you know, that sounds so trite in a way, right? And I've hated that working class designation, but it's just an easy term, right? It's people having all the experiences and feelings and struggles with issues of loss, of abandonment, of who am I, of desire, all these things, but in the context of being in this sort of social place, right? That gets missed a lot, you know? It gets missed. And he got it, right? Without talking down to anybody, you know, because he was from it. And it's there. And that's really important to me. I mean, I'm going to have a book of poems out. And it's not that I'm doing anything earth-shattering. It's just that, you know, I'm writing anecdotal narrative / lyric poems from working out of the grist of my own life and experiences and things I've seen, people I've known. But it's, you know, I've developed a voice that's wholly my own within that. But that's a very unpopular sort of take on poetry these days, right? There's a lot of focus on the new poetry, which is really influenced by postmodern ideas and all that. And I don't really have much time for that stuff. Again, I just think it's another fucking conceit by the middle class to extend their control over things and their sense of entitlement, which they can't really prop up anymore, but they're finding ways to prop it up by saying it's not legitimate, but nothing is legitimate. So we're as equally illegitimate as the rest of you, but because of that, we're perfectly entitled to continue doing what we want to do, and fuck you. All right? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Pretty circular reasoning, but yeah, fuck postmodernism and fuck them all. Like, seriously. And that's what I like about Levine, is he would understand that.
Tell me about Mark Twain.
Oh, Mark Twain. Oh, my God. You know, to be honest, there's only two books of his that I've read a lot as a kid, which was Tom Sawyer and then The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Even if he had never written anything but The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, that would be enough to have him forever enshrined. And I mean, I grew up with that book. I probably read it 25 times as a kid.
How did it come into your life?
Found it at the school library. I read Tom Sawyer, and I love Tom Sawyer. Tom Sawyer was just an adventure book. He was sort of this, you know, kind of a middle-class kid, but he was, you know, rebellious and, you know, doing what young boys do, which, or at least young boys that I knew, which was always getting into trouble. And but then Huckleberry Finn was just this whole other universe. I mean, it's also the American element, which can't be downplayed. I mean, I'm an American. I grew up an American, and I was indoctrinated into Americanness, you know, and I believed profoundly in it as a little kid. I was so proud to be an American, and, you know, and we were about freedom and democracy and all these things that we were told, liberty and integrity, and oh God, it was such bullshit, and I bought into it. And in a way, Huckleberry Finn puts the lie to a lot of that. Just the struggles that Huck has around his relationship with Jim, you know, who's an escaped slave, and that who Huck has been taught to not see as a person. And he has to really struggle. He struggles with that. Yet his better nature wins out. And I felt like Huck had like an alcoholic father. I had a crazy alcoholic father. Huck didn't want to be a part of the civilizing world around him, nor did I, you know, the religious folks that were trying to control my life. You know, I ran away several times. Huck ran away, you know, and the adventures that he had on the road, I mean, you know, it was about these hugely, huge places to me. It's about the Mississippi River. I mean, you can't underestimate the symbolic, mysterious aura of all things America that the Mississippi held for me as a little boy. you know, just even the portions where he describes sitting on the raft with Jim in the middle of the night, staring up at the stars. I mean, and the quiet of this huge expansive river that they're on, and having this experience for days on end, you know, floating through this vastness of America, and just being on a raft, and I related it to all the time I spent on the Allegheny River, right? Because I lived right next to it in Pittsburgh. And I mean, my book is all about the Allegheny River.
The Allegheny. What a filthy river. Lined with steel mills and factories. To swim in it was to smell for days the oily stink against your skin. A nausea twist in your stomach. Uneasy reminder of the river's phlegmy, dark green clutch. It was as dangerous as it was dirty. The bottom, dug out for gravel, unnaturally and unevenly deep, held invisible currents, eddies, undertows that could pull, suck, and hold you down until you drown. Or throw you up again to limb flash, flail, and suck for air. Each summer it claimed a child from the cancerous towns along its sides, as if it were an angry, wounded god demanding tribute. Each summer, we gathered there to fish for monstrous carp and catfish no one would ever eat. To swim and dunk each other beneath the blinding water. To watch the rich kids carve into the current white-tipped waves. Bronze bodies balanced on single skis behind small, sleek powerboats. By the docks, we bobbed in water warm as blood. The sunlight marching like fire across the oily surface to burn away all but summer's touch. We swam beside the hulk of coal barges, black as the Bible's curse that tore the earth. All summer, we swam in it. What a filthy river.
Do you remember at all what it felt like to read it for the first time?
Yeah, I couldn't stop. I'd stayed up all night with a flashlight under my covers.
Had you ever experienced anything like that before?
No. I mean, I couldn't really frame it, right? I mean, it was difficult for me to... I couldn't have explained to you what I felt. Because I had already read Tom Sawyer, and I love Tom Sawyer. And so when I saw the name Mark Twain on this book in the library, I thought, oh, more of the same. Yay, right? But it's so far beyond. Huck Finn it's a piece of literature. It does feel like... He comes by everything honestly, even though he's a fucking rogue, right? And by the time Tom fucking makes an appearance in that novel, and it's a scathing indictment of this sort of middle-class kid, middle-class world that Tom represents, right? Because Tom comes in at the end, and there's some very real fucking stakes on the table for Jim. And there's some very real fucking stakes on the table for Huck. And Tom makes a game of the whole thing. And it's a lark for him. He's summoning it for a while. You know, it's just a world of adventures that he's living out of books that he's read. So he toys with it. And then, you know, at the end he reveals that, oh, it was okay. You know, Jim was freed and blah, blah. I believe Jim had been freed by the end of the novel. And so Tom has this knowledge. And Tom isn't Huck's equal. What Huck has been through in the course of that book, the situations he's faced, the way that he's dealt with them and survived them, Tom is leagues behind Huck as an accomplished human being. Huck has met a lot of things and come through them. Where what has Tom really done? And yet he has this sense of entitlement, the sense of leadership. Why? Because he's a middle-class kid, really, at the end. And then, God, I'm fucking ranting against middle class. I'm sorry. But I do take that as a bit of an... I felt like Huck throughout the book, right? I was this poor kid, fucked up family. You know, I would run away. You know, I met all kinds of characters. I mean, it spoke to me.
Stars stretched out across the night. Well, they might not be there. Sometimes you can't even trust the light. Your waste of restless sand, it dissolves in the air. this for 40 days now, and it might be 40 years. Standing in the doorway with my back to these tears. Walking down the hallway, love, how can you ask me if I care?
For more information on Rodney DeCrew's music and poetry, check out his blog at rodneydecrew.tumblr.com. You can also find him at myspace.com/wartornman. And you can buy his CDs at CD Baby. I'm TJ Dahl, and this has been a Totem Figures podcast.
Trying so hard to finish, but you know I can't.